The contrast between power and force is given dramatically by a historical example of the British Empire, the vis-a-vis Mahatma Gandhi. Well, Mahatma Gandhi, as you know, was an ascetic, Hindu ascetic, and if you calibrate Gandhi, he's over 700. At the time that he confronted the British Empire was the greatest force the world had ever seen. It ruled one quarter of the world, a third of the planet, and the seas. So it was the greatest force the world had ever seen, the British Empire. And when I grew up, the British Empire was still the great British Empire, upon which the sun never set. Against that stood a little 90-pound Hindu, Indian, skin and bones, stood up to the British Empire, stood up to the lion. So here's this 90-pound ascetic who can then confronts the great lion that ruled one-third of the planet. The interesting thing is that Mahatma Gandhi, by doing nothing, in fact, just saying he's going to stop eating, and if they didn't like it, he'd just starve to death, threw the world into a panic. And at 700, Gandhi stood there. Well, 700 is, of course, enormous power, extremely rare on the planet, and faced off the British Empire, which in its pridefulness and self-interest calibrated at 190, and without firing one single shot, defeated the entire British Empire and took it apart and brought the end of colonialism, which was followed by other nations then who also, one after another, gave up their colonialism. So it was not only the British Empire, but colonialism per se that he defeated. And self-rule became the dominant political system in the world today. So what Gandhi really represents then, just like AA, the 12-step movements, all spiritual groups around the world, is they demonstrate the influence of power. Power doesn't cause things. You know, force can be said to cause things within the Newtonian paradigm. Power influences things. Now, you know that a quirk is going to rise depending on the density of the medium that it finds itself. So by prayer, by spiritual evolution, what happens then is that mankind creates a very powerful field, this field of spiritual reality, which then begins to lift and affect all of mankind. It affects the whole paradigm of reality and values. So as we mentioned before, integrity is now becoming a predominant value in our society. It's being talked about constantly in the media. So we have a whole new value system. Now that was not brought about by the mechanism of force. Nobody forced the news or the media to begin valuing integrity, but integrity as a social value, I'm speaking, not as a spiritual value, but as a social value. So we all live by our own principles. So spiritual growth then means what principles do we live by? And as we grow and mature, we choose different principles. You know, some people live by the principle of always be right. Never give the sucker a break. People come out and state what their principles are. Sometimes they seem quite outlandish, but you could say they're integrous to the degree that they live by them. To the degree that they live by them, they are living by what they're committed to. So I respect what people say they're committed to, and I think to the degree they live by that, then they're being virtuous by their own definition. So calibrated level of consciousness to some degree then reflects the degree to which we live by our own stated spiritual choice. You might say karma or spiritual destiny. A calibrated level of consciousness then is the consequence of spiritual freedom of choice. So we have freedom of choice at every moment. But this freedom of choice seems to be obscure. We seem to be run by programs. And one reason that we try to transcend the ego is because we don't want to be at the effect of the ego. We would like the mind to stop long enough for us to deliberate and make a choice. And so often we do a thing quickly and we regret it later. And you sort of get a resentment. Gee, I didn't really have a moment to really think about that. Our spiritual choices then tend to determine which way we choose when the moment arises. If it wasn't for the silence of consciousness, you would not be able to know what you're thinking. It's because of the silence of the forest that you can hear sound. It's because the mind is silent, you can hear or see or picture what you're thinking. Therefore, the content of the mind must be going on in the space of no mind, which is a classical term, meaning thoughtless, formless consciousness upon which thoughts reflect themselves. So we withdraw our investment and preoccupation and identification with the content of thinking and begin to see that we're the space in which thinking can occur. So the value of meditation then is it focuses us so that we withdraw our investment and identification with the content of thought to the space in which the thought is occurring. And we begin to see that there is a witness to the thinking, there is an awareness to the witness, and that there's a substrate that underlies all of it that is beyond time, beyond dimension, and that it is independent of personal identification. And the identification then with consciousness itself lifts us out of the identification of our reality as either the body or the mind or the thoughts or the feelings and takes us to a greater dimension. As we move into that greater dimension then, we confirm the spiritual reality which underlies our existence. People become involved in spiritual work on a practical level. They want to know, how can I forgive my enemies when I hate them so much after all they've done to me? How can I feel hope when I'm really depressed? How can I get rid of fear when I'm scared all the time? So it starts out on a very practical, many people start out on a very practical, nitty-gritty level. Other people start out from a different level. They start out through inspiration. They will hear an inspirational speaker and get uplifted. So one can start from curiosity. One can start from sort of a spontaneous evolution of within one's own consciousness. I think spiritually evolved people inspire others outside of their awareness. Because they influence the field, people that would not ordinarily not be interested in spirituality suddenly become curious, not through any inner prompting, but as a consequence of the field. So if you're around people who are more spiritually evolved, one finds one's own interest in it spontaneously becoming more intense, not through any deliberate decision-making, but just because it's more interesting. The same as if you're around people that are into sports, you tend to listen to it more and be more interested in it. We hear all the time clinically, you know, people have some kind of disaster in their life, you know, and we hear it all the time about an illness or drugs or alcohol or criminality or grief or loss. And what can they do about it? The willingness to surrender life to God, of course, is one of the most profound spiritual tools. So people ask, what spiritual tools are the most powerful? I would say humility, the willingness to surrender life, to let go and to control it, to let go and to change it. The willingness to surrender how you see things to God, then, or to some higher spiritual principle, because God is not a reality. It's just a word to most people, a hoped-for reality, but not an experiential reality to most people until they become more spiritually advanced and begin to experience the presence of the field itself and intuit its enormous power. And then they reverence God because they respect the infinite power that they begin to intuit. So what we can do on a practical level then is become the best person we can become. I'd say to become kind towards all of life in all of its expressions, no matter what. And that includes oneself, to be willing to forgive oneself, to see the limitation of human consciousness. I always feel that the more educated you are about the quality of consciousness, the nature of consciousness, the easier it is to follow spiritual principles. If you understand that human consciousness is intrinsically innocent and cannot control that which it's programmed by, because it can't tell truth from falsehood, you begin to feel compassion automatically. So I feel one reason I like the lecture is because certain pieces of information are already transformational. You don't have to sit down and sit cross-legged and do mantras and meditate for hours at a time or go to an ashram. Once you understand the intrinsic innocence of human consciousness, you instantly are able to forgive people. So I've been impressed by the power of spiritual truth conveying information. That's why I do the research, and that's why I write and talk about it. It's good to merely to have heard it already changes how you feel and see it altogether already. If the human being can't tell truth from falsehood, how can you fault it or kill it for being false? You can feel sorry for it. So now, instantly, you understand what the Buddha said. There's only one sin, and that's ignorance, which is the same thing that Jesus said, and which Krishna said. So Krishna said, those who reverence me, even though they're totally mistaken, wandering in the wrong direction, belong to me, they are mine. In the end run, then, man is forgiven because of his profound ignorance. And if he knew better, he would do better. He can't do better until he knows better. So the evolution of consciousness is then the means by which man learns to know better.